your tears on my pillow that won't dry on their own beyond my ears. I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone. Step by step, step by step, step by day, I'm on the run to recovery, trusting God along the way, trusting God along the way, trusting God all the way.
Hi, everyone. Let's get started. Let's start up with Ryan, who's going to tell us a joke.
Hi, I'm Ryan. She goes on to say, I'm just here to get paper signed for my parole officer in the parole program. The man asks, what did you do? She replies, I murdered my husband in a drunken rage. And the man says, so you're single, huh?
Thank you, Ryan. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Study. My name is Mitzi, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Thank you for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start with a two-minute meditation, so please take this time to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise, that might and will disturb others. Take this time to connect with God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready?
Yes.
Okay, let's get started. Me in the fog light prayer. It's right up there. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Amen. From the big book, there is a solution, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out, which we absolutely agree upon, which can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries for those of us who suffer from alcoholism. And I have asked Savannah to read a spiritual experience. From Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience, we read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is.
Spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is condemned prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
So please remain... Please refrain from talking to each other or constantly getting up during the meeting. This is a text-free meeting, so please set your phones on airport mode or just turn them off. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Patsy, our speaker tonight.
Thank you. Good job. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Pat. And thanks to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program of AA, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And for that, I'll be forever grateful. AA didn't just save my life, but it gave me one worth living. And if it hadn't, I wouldn't be here. You know, I have an absolute blast in recovery. Have a lot of fun. And I'm glad to be here. And thank you for the invitation. This is one of my favorite places to be. I love you guys. You know, I love coming here. I think it was about a year ago this time that I was here last. And so I'm looking forward to a new journey through the steps because I get as much out of this as you do. It's always an experience for me to do this. I don't enjoy it necessarily. I'd much rather be in the book, wherever it is. My whoopee. In case I blank, I'm going there, you know what I mean? But I'm much more comfortable doing that and being true to the literature, but... When you do this, it's exposing. You get to really know me, and I get to really know myself a little bit too. So I learn a lot through these journeys. It seems like every time I do one of these step series, something significant takes place in my life, or I've just gone through something significant, and my experience changes with the information. Not that the information changes, but my experience with it is. I don't know if you guys ever read something out of the book and just go, where the hell did that come from? You know, and I go through those moments all the time, or, you know, that it means something different to me than it did last year. And it's truly a living document in my experience. And so I'm going to share that experience with you guys over the next 12 weeks. I'm really nervous. I don't know why. When I first started doing speaking in AA, and I thought, man, I can't wait till this nervousness goes away. And 26 years later, I'm still but I'll settle in. So if you're waiting for it to go away, it just may not. I still shake even sharing at meetings. I don't know what's up with it. I think it keeps me honest. I don't know. It makes me prepare. Keeps me humble, maybe. But so we're going to talk about step one tonight. And that we were powerless over alcohol, hyphen, that our lives were unmanageable. Not and our lives were unmanageable. That our lives are unmanageable. And what it means. And we're going to spend a lot of time on that. We're probably going to spend the next 3 or 4 weeks just talking about that powerlessness and that unmanageability, and and I kind of break it down. I mean, we talk about the first part of that. You know, we admitted we were powerless. What does it mean to be powerless? I think, you know, we hear so many different things in the rooms. You know, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. Well, yeah, okay. You know, and that may be true. You know, that's not why I drank, but it may be true. You know, but what it means in Alcoholics Anonymous to be powerless is what Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion is that. You know, when I really want to stay stopped, I can't. And once I start, I can't control the amount I take. I mean, those two questions that they're going to talk about at least 4 different times, which is really about what the first 4 chapters are all about. There's not a whole lot of ideas in those, but they're repeated. Basic ideas are repeated over and over and over again. And so, I mean, if you wonder, am I powerless or not? Well, when you really want to stay stopped, you find you can't stay stopped. Given sufficient reason, you know, divorce, bankruptcy, you know, jail, institutions, you know, loss of job. I mean, you're given a pretty good reason to stay stopped, and you pick up anyway. Have a seat. You know, if once you start, you can't control the amount you take. The book says you're probably alcoholic. You know, it only says probably because we can't label you alcoholic. But let me tell you something: if you're going to go to jail, if you pick up and you pick up, you're one of us. Welcome. You know, I've been that guy. When she says I'm leaving, and you pick up anyway. You know, after you've sworn off in the morning by 5 o'clock, you're thinking, what's the big deal? I don't think she's really going to go. You know. And you find your way, you find yourself talking yourself into a drink. Have a seat. I think the idea of choice and control is really what the first step is all about. You know, I mean, to me, it's about choice and control. You know, and I've never been able to, and I didn't know that, by the way. I didn't know that until I was told that here. I had no idea that I thought I changed my mind. You know, I thought when the judge said, if you pick up again, you're going to jail. I said, okay, I get it. I'm clear on that. You know, I got it. You know, jail, drink, got it. You know. But somewhere along the line, that it gets blurry. You know, it just, you know, did he really mean it? You know, I wonder what he really meant by that, you know. I mean, did he really mean just? I mean, I could have a couple. I think what he meant was don't get drunk again, and then I would be off on another run, you know. And the control issue, I don't even know what that means. I don't know what it means to control my consumption. Why would you, right? Why would you want to? And wasn't the point of the exercise to get loaded? I mean, wasn't that the point of the exercise? Is there any social drinker? I don't think there's any social drinkers here, you know. We were in New York recently, and my wife and I were in Central Park. We were Tavern on the Green, and we were having lunch at Tavern on the Green, and we're sitting there, and these two couples come in, and they sit down beside us, and they order a glass of wine and a couple of sandwiches, and they drink half the glass of wine, and they leave. You know, and we're looking at each other and say, "There's no way they left." You know, you know. I mean, they're I don't know what they're doing, but there's no way. I mean, they just disappeared. You know, and I just can't fathom that. Did they not like it? You know. We took pictures. We took pictures of it, put it on Facebook, sent it down. Look at this, you know. And all our people are going, "Damn, what's wrong with them?" You know. My mother go, "What? What? What are we looking at? You know, there's nobody there." But everybody I knew, wow, who left that two half glasses of wine on the table? So I don't know what that is. Look, you crackheads, I'm not talking to you. You know, you guys get the control. I love sponsoring crackheads because they get the control. Yeah, I got it. Move on. You know, I got it. Yeah. You know, when you take one hit and then you lose all, I got it. You don't have to spend much time with them. I mean, they're heartbreaking, by the way, but you don't have to spend much time about obsession and compulsion with those guys. They get it, man. You know, just going to smoke one. Hold my money. Next thing you see him with the TV. You know, like, right? Where's your car, dude? I didn't need it. I ain't got no job, what I need a car for. They're fun to sponsor. I think it's clear. I think what it means to, I think the book is clear on what it means to be powerless. It really is. I mean, you may not be clear on it, but the book is clear on it. And they're going to reiterate that over and over and over again. And we're going to talk about that over and over and over again. And the question becomes, why can't I stay stopped? That becomes the question, because if it was just a physical aspect, it was just, okay, I get it. Don't take, and we hear that when we come in here, right? It's the first one that gets you drunk. That baffled me when I heard it. No, it ain't, you know. It's like the 10th one to get, you know, the first one. You know, I didn't get what they were talking about, but they're, you know, and we hear that all, like that put the plug in the jug mentality, right? Just don't pick up the first one. Like, okay. Nice seeing you. Because that's their solution. That's a lot of people's solution. Don't drink and go to meetings. That's a solution. If you don't drink and go to meetings, you're not going to hear the solution. You need to not drink and go to meetings. That's the first step. You know, if you're coming here drunk, not going to happen. You know, but going to meetings is where you're going to find the information, but that's not a cure-all for alcoholism. That never kept me stopped. You know, the consequences never kept me stopped. Information. If it was just about the information, you know, Bill Wilson gets that information the second time he lands in detox. Why did he land in there three more times? You know, he had the right information. He had Silk Force information about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. You know, now that I have that knowledge, it's unthinkable that I'll pick up. But he couldn't stay stopped either, and I couldn't stay stopped. I gave up a lot of stuff because I couldn't stay stopped, but I had no idea. I had no idea. You know, I really didn't know what it meant. And so there lies the question. There lies in my mind, and I'm going to share my experience with you tonight, because look, this is all about experience to me. This program, that's the tool that we have that nobody else has, is our experience. That's kind of what makes us all uniquely valuable in this room. Every single person in this room is uniquely valuable because you have a story, and somebody needs to hear your story. I don't need to hear mine. Somebody might need to hear mine, but somebody needs to hear every story. That's why there's 42 stories. And so if you don't identify with mine, read 42 of them in the back of the book in Bill's. You know, the book starts page one with a story. You know, there's a reason for that. Because our experience is unique. When the doctor and the clergy and the psychiatrist tells us, I know how you feel. No, they don't. No, they don't. You know they don't. You know when they tell you that, they don't. They've never taken a drink or a drug against their own better judgment. They've never said, this is not a good idea, and done it anyway. How many can relate to that, right? This is not going to end well, but I need it. We know where it's going. It's not even like we can't see the end. I know. I got a damn warrant. I know where it's going. You know, she's packed. I know where this is leading. But that truth is blocked out by the need. You know, what is that need? You know, Bill, the doctor calls it an obsession. You know, Bill talks about it later on. He calls it a spiritual malady. You know, it's an emotional condition for me, and it's always been an emotional condition for me. And you may or may not relate to that. I've always been, as the doctor describes, restless, irritable, and discontent. I hated my childhood. I was not a happy kid. You know, hated it. You know, the unmanageability. The emotional condition that I was in as a child was unbearable. And I acted out in a lot of ways, even as a young kid, as a five-year-old, a six-year-old. I acted out in a lot of ways that, to try to not feel. You know, and I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if it was, it was a violent household. There's no doubt about that. My dad was a maniac. You know, my dad, you never know who was coming in that door at night. And I didn't even know that he was a drinker till years later. I didn't know there was alcohol involved in my family until I was allowed to drink with them. Then I realized, this is some fun shit right here. This is some good stuff. But I didn't know. I didn't know that there was alcohol involved. I know there was infidelity involved. I knew that. You know, my dad just didn't come home. And when he came home, there was hell to pay when he got there. So you didn't know who was going to walk in the door. You didn't know if he was going to come in the door and beat the crap out of my mother, which happened often. You know, which my mother, she, you know, where the hell were you? She'd ask something stupid like that, you know. Where you been for the last couple of days? You know, something stupid like you would ask your husband, where you been for the last couple of days? And he would go off, you know, in front of us. I have a picture in my mind of me and my three siblings. My youngest sister wasn't born yet. It was me and my two siblings, my sister and my brother, sitting on the couch watching TV while my dad was on top of my mother slapping the shit out of her and ripping her clothes off because he didn't like what she was wearing that night. Now, she probably just asked, where were you? And that's where it went. Now, I didn't know there was alcohol involved in that until later. Now, that will give a child a slightly nervous disposition. You know, you start to twitch. You know, you develop these twitches and ticks, you know, and an arm would fly up for no reason. You know, just a nervous wreck of a kid, you know. And look, out of four kids, there was only one of us who's a normie. You know, there's you know, three of us that are in recovery. Well, I lost my sister about 6 years ago to an overdose, but my youngest sister. But. So I don't know. You know, maybe I was just wired different. You know, I've read books on stuff like that because I wanted a healing in recovery, and I was reading all kind of books on healings and why am I an emotional cripple? You know, why do I not like the way I feel when I'm not medicated? You know, what causes that restlessness, that irritability, what causes that emotional condition? What causes that spiritual malady that Bill's talking about that prevents me from doing life like a normal person? I just didn't feel normal. I was like, it's a miracle that I get up here at this podium because I was a kid at 5 years old. I started first grade at five. I was younger than everybody else, shorter. And my mom was trying to support, at that time, three kids on her own while my dad was bouncing in and out of the home. You know, so I didn't even know how to write my name when I got to first grade. I was just behind all the time. And if I would have my homework done and they would ask me to get up in the front of the class and read a homework, I'd say, no way, that ain't happening. I'll go home, I'll take the F, just move on. You know, just move along, I'm not doing it. And I would take the F. Just fear of not being good enough, fear of failure, fear of not having the right answer. And that carried on all through my childhood, my teen years. I wouldn't try out for certain things in fear of failure. You know, I don't want to look bad. You know, what will they think about me if I look bad? And, you know, I knew I was never going to go out. I knew I was never going to have the nerve to ask a girl out. I knew I was going to be single the rest of my life. That just wasn't going to happen. That rejection, I would have shot myself. You know, I mean, so, would you go out with me? No. I'm done. You know, that suicide stuff right there, that kind of rejection is terminal, you know. So I don't know what wired me that way. Maybe it was the violence. Maybe it was I was just born that way. Maybe my mother did something when I don't know. You know, I don't know what was going on there, you know. So, and I don't know if it matters anymore. I remember Mark Houston talking about that I spent years of therapy trying to figure that out. And now I know and nothing changed. I still feel like shit. One of my favorite talks that he does when he talks about the internal condition. And that's when I identified with the spiritual malady, that internal condition. Clancy talks about that spring that just winds up. And I got to do something. And before the drink, the something, maybe it was sexual, maybe it was just a motorcycle. How fast can I go on this motorcycle? Or, you know, I remember jumping off of buildings to see how high I could jump off a building without landing in the hospital. You know, just stupid crap. I mean, it sounds insane, but I was doing a lot of stuff to try to get out of my own head at a young age. And, you know, so I can't wait. My mom ended up remarrying another violent guy, and he was a drinker. I knew he was a drinker. He was a bartender at a club downtown Pittsburgh. And he would come home just loaded, and she'd ask the same stupid question, you know, like, where were you? And all hell would break loose again. By now, I'm numb to it. You know, I just can't wait to get the hell out of this house. And I know my driver's license is my ticket to freedom. You know, I bought a car at 14. You know, knowing 2 years from now I'll have a license and I'll be able to leave the house. I mean, it was the longest 2 years of my life. I was marking like 700 more days, 699 more days, and I'll have my daughter. I mean, it was really that kind of, did you ever, like, be looking forward to something? It seems like it takes forever, right? And it seemed like it. So at 16, I turned 16, I go down to the driver's license bureau, get my learner's permit. I drive with a learner's permit to, actually, I drove without a driver's license, without a learner's permit, to Harrisburg to get my learner's permit, and drove back, took my test, and I knew I was free. I knew I was out, and it was just a matter of days before I was going to leave the house. And my cousin, Russell, found out that I had got my driver's license, and now they had wheels, is what they were thinking, right? We got wheels. Because Pat's got a car and he got a license. He got them both. And so he calls me up and says, I want to go to this dance tonight. He says, our band is playing over there. Why don't you come pick us up and we'll go to the dance? I go, no, no. You know, I don't dance. That's one thing. I wasn't, no way. I wasn't getting out there making a fool of myself. You know. And I said, I don't dance, Russ. That's all right. No, he said, no, you'll have fun. You just come and listen to the band. You know. All right. So I pick him up. And I pick up our buddy Rat. Anybody else have a buddy Rat? No. It wasn't because he was a snitch. He kind of looked like a rat. Rat was a 15-year-old Italian dude that looked 30, right? He was our go. Anybody from Pennsylvania? Right? State stores? Right? Beer distributors, right? You can't go into a 7-Eleven. When I came down here and saw liquor in a 7-Eleven, I went, heaven, you know? You got to go to a state store and produce an LCB card, liquor control board card, to get liquor in Pennsylvania. And Rat looked 40. He was losing his hair at 15, you know? And hair coming out of his shirt, you know, he walked in there, he could get anything. So Rat goes into the state store and picks up a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And orange vodka, so we're outside the dance, and I'm on the wall, you know, like I always do. That's when I went to a dance. Like, I didn't go to the proms and the homecomings, all that stuff. I just didn't go. You know, I wasn't going to ask somebody to go first off, and I didn't dance. So I usually, like, stood on the wall and asked, just prayed that somebody would be desperate enough to ask me to dance, you know, and that never happened. But halfway through that ball of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, the planets aligned. You know, I mean, everything came together. I got tall enough and strong enough and good-looking enough to get on that dance floor. And I was, you might be, you know, I probably should change this story, but I was John Travolta out there. I was like, staying alive, baby, you know. I had the pose going. You know, I was the man on the dance floor. I was all over that dance floor. I had the absolute time of my life. I was the guy, ladies, that you were trying to get away from, but I would keep showing up in front of you, you know? And just like, I never left the dance floor. I had the absolute time of my life. The fear was gone. The fear of rejection was gone. And I was perfect. Life was perfect. That moment, by the way, will be imprinted on my brain forever. Forever. When I have a stressor come into my life, my mind will go boom back to the Boone's Farm and say, there's where the planets align, right there. I need something powerful to overcome that, I can tell you right now. You know, because that was a perfect moment. And I'll tell you what, I mean, I was sick as a dog. I mean, can you imagine mixing the Boone's Farm and the orange vodka, where that went, you know? Couldn't wait to do it again, though. Couldn't wait to do it again. I didn't draw a sober breath for the next 20 years. And that's just no lie. I found the solution. If I could define a spiritual awakening, that was it. That was it right there. This is perfect. And I wanted to be that. I was never going back to that scared kid again. That internal condition that Mark talked about, that emotional condition that I suffered from all those years was gone. It was gone. Now, there was a whole new kind of unmanageability that was created out of that. You know, went through a windshield 3 days later, right? Drunk driver. Got arrested 3 times that year. I lost my driver's license before my 17th birthday. I didn't get that back until 1980. That was 1972 when I got my driver's license. Right? I love what Bill says in his story, ominous warnings, which I failed to heed. You know, because everybody around me was, I got my, you know, first felony at 19 years old. You know, it just started a slippery slope down there. Ominous warnings, which I failed to heed. Everybody around me is going, dude, like, this is not working. And I'm going, oh, this is fine. You know, I'll figure it out. Got caught 3 more times driving under suspension before my 18th birthday. You know, first felony at 19. You know, I wasn't looking back, though. There was no way I was going back. Yeah. I got married. It's my pattern is have a child, get married. That's my pattern. You know, 1978, I have a son. 79, I get married. 1980, I move to South Florida. Guess what's going on in South Florida? Cocaine cowboy, baby. You know, I live at Oakland Park and Powerline. That's where 9th Avenue. I live right behind the Fort Lauderdale Airport, 43rd Street and 43rd Street and Andrews. That's where I live. Right. They were delivering it to the job site. It was awesome. Yeah. I found a way to drink around the clock, right, and still make it to work. I look back at that, and I said, I used to spend $300 to go to work to make $80. The math doesn't work. But that was my deal. You know, I medicate. Look, I took that drink at 16. I don't know what it means. I don't know what they talk about when they talk about crossing a line. You know, my drug of choice became whatever you had. I mean, that really was what it was. Alcohol is my favorite. The quality is always good. The accessibility is there. You know, it did what I needed it to do. I didn't have to go to a bad area to get it, you know. You know, it was just perfect. I could always, but if you add something else to enhance that experience, I'm down with it. Just tell me what direction we're going. I just want to be prepared. You know, you know, we going up or down? Where are we going? You know, I want to know if I should be like holding on to something, or are we going to run all night? I don't know. You know. How my wife at the time stayed with me, but I became an absentee husband, an absentee father for the next 10 years. You know, I was just on a run. I racked up hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. You know, I was paying my mortgage with my credit cards and snorting my mortgage, you know, and it was just the way it was, you know. And our alcoholic addict life becomes the normal life. You know, it wasn't abnormal for me to land in jail. I mean, I landed in county jail here before I was only here 6 months. Ended up in county. I got profiled, though. I will tell you that. White dude, company truck, riding through the hood. That's profiling right there. That ain't right. That ain't right. My first trip to county to Broward County Jail. You think some of that stuff, like a normal person would go, you know, that's enough, you know, enough. Not me, man. I was not going to quit until I had to quit. You know, my wife, 10 years into our marriage, she wanted out. She would do anything to get out. I actually got custody of my son in 1979 or 89. I got custody of my son, got the house, got the car, I got everything. She just wanted out. She went to a woman's shelter to get the hell away. You know, the house was starting to get violent. You know, I was starting to become the person I hated in my father. You know, I was coming home and she'd ask me that stupid question. Where were you? What? You're not my mother. So I'm sitting alone in my house, my 4-2 with a pool, by myself with my son in the other room, and I probably have the first ever moment of clarity in my life. The first, Bill talks about this bitter morass of self-pity. You know, I was halfway through a bottle of Jose Cuervo 1800, and I was sitting there and feeling sorry for myself, and how could this bitch do this to me? You know, where we go. You know, after all I've done for her, you know, this house and everything I've given her, how could this bitch do this, you know? And I picked up a .38 and tried to off myself. And I flinched when I pulled the trigger and shot my waterbed. That didn't go well. That ruined the moment, I'll tell you that. Sobered my ass up, man. Yeah. You know, I choke when I talk about that because I had a 10-year-old in the other room that I never even thought of one second about his welfare. I never, ever, ever considered the impact that would have had on my son had I been successful. Never. Never entered my mind. Matter of fact, that never entered my mind until I was in recovery and making a damn amends list and realized the impact, just that impact had on him, let alone had I been successful, what that impact would have had. Just caught up in self, man. Just, it's all about me. I'm the victim. You know, I've always been a victim. I've always been in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people doing the wrong thing. It's just, why is everybody picking on me? You know, why me, man? Me. Yeah. You know, the upside of that attempt was that, and tell me she ain't sick, she came back. Because she saw that I was remorseful and that maybe this could work. What happens? We're already divorced. What happens? We have another child. And we stay together while I hit a physical bottom. You know, I couldn't stop. The promises we make. I never said I would never drink again. I never said that. I said I will stop doing the drugs, and I will only drink on weekends. God, I had no idea how long it was from Monday to Saturday. That is brutal. That is a long. That's like waiting 2 years to get your driver's license. You know what I mean? That's a long way. You know, to hold your breath for a week is really what it was like. It was just, I couldn't do it. I started closet drinking. I was drinking out and coming home with, you know, mouthwash. And nobody will know. I come staggering in the house. And it took me 2 years to hit a physical bottom. I got shut off at Brady's Lounge. Nobody gets shut off at Brady's Lounge in North Lauderdale. I mean, that was a dive. I got shut off in Brady. You know, they got this thing about urinating yourself in the bar. You know, I was losing bodily functions. I was, you know, waking up in my own urine, making excuses. You know, 125 pounds when I landed in here. I'm 165. I don't look good at 125. And I don't, you know, I came home from a night of drinking, and I don't even know what she asked me. I don't even know what the question was. And in front of my two boys, I knocked my wife down. Paulo in his story always talks about what I thought was the worst day of my life became the best day of my life. And I could say that a couple times, you know, that I thought that was the worst day of my life. When I gave my sons the same picture that I had as a child, that they'll never forget, was watching their mother hit the floor and then watching the police come and cuff their father, and watching them standing outside while the neighbors and everybody around, while the SWAT team is at the house, like I'm some kind of criminal. Somebody mentioned he had a gun. I don't know what the hell, you know. Guess she did, bitch. Yeah. And I hit the restraining order, the lawsuit, assault and battery. You know what they do. And I end up at a Days Inn at Commercial Boulevard and 441. It's now a La Quinta. It's a southeast corner. I'll never forget that place. I go by there all the time to remind me. I end up in that hotel room for almost 3 weeks. And I hit a place that I've never seen before. I just was never there before, where I'm not getting the relief out of the drink anymore, and I can't stop. And that's a tough deal. And I've hit that place here, too, by the way, where I can't stand the way I feel anymore, and I can't drink. It's the same place as I was in that hotel room, is I can't stand the way I feel anymore, and the drink isn't working. Now what? And that's a tough, so I find myself getting up to get drunk, to pass out, to get up, to get drunk, to pass out, because I can't stand me. I can't stand reflection. I can't stand what's going on in my life. I can't stand my life. And I'm really that five-year-old again that won't get up in front of a class anymore. I don't even want to go to work. I don't know what to put on. I don't even know what to wear. I don't even know what to... I get up and I look in the closet and I go, okay, have another drink and go back to bed. You know? And I have, you know, one of those unexplainable moments, those God moments that take place in our lives that we look back at. And I had never considered coming into AA. Nobody had ever told me to come into AA. It was just, I had never considered not drinking. But I have this moment of clarity. I believe it's a moment of God's grace that comes down on. I think sometimes we refer to it as this pink cloud that we get on when we come into early recovery. I think it's a spiritual window. I think it's God's grace coming on us and saying, here's an opportunity for you to turn your life around. And I have this thought, I should go to AA. I should call my sister. Now, my sister had been in AA for years. And I should call my sister, and I do. And I make the phone call. My sister picks up the phone. Now, I don't know if she doesn't pick up the phone, whether I get sober or not. I don't know. You know how quickly that window closes, right? You guys have been there before. I think I should stop. Boom, that shuts, you know. Screw that, you know. Yeah, I should make a phone call. It rings two times. Okay, he didn't answer, you know. She picks up the phone. Boom. And I said, look, I need help. And she takes me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Fifth Chapter Club in Lighthouse Point. I don't remember the meeting. I know it was a Big Book meeting. I have no idea what they talked about, you know. I know I went in that meeting room and was just as uncomfortable as I was in first grade. And I sat on the back wall. I said, you know, I could refer to as wall of shame or relapse row, whatever you want. I was on that back wall, you know. And I knew if it came close to me to read or something, I was getting the hell out of there, or, you know, if anybody asked me to do anything. But I do remember... the guy chairing it looked just like Papa Smurf. He looked white beard, white hair. I found out years later that his name was Lee May. God rest his soul. And Lee got up at the end of the meeting and asked if there was anybody that wanted to start a new way of life. And I don't know if he asked that question in any other way if I get up out of that chair. Are you ready to give up the fight? Hell no. I was sitting in that meeting trying to figure out how I was going to get back into the house. How am I going to get custody of my son back? You know, that's what was going through my mind. How am I going to win this war? Are you ready to surrender? No. Hell no, I'm not ready to surrender. But he asked, is there anybody that wants to start a new way of life? God, I jumped up out of that chair. I don't even know what made me get up. I jumped out and picked up a white chip. It's the only white chip I've ever picked up. It was March 26, 1991. And my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started that night. And I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since then. Have I wanted to pick up a drink? Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have. It wasn't a miracle. I was kind of put in this little cocoon of grace, I like to call it, for a little while. I fell in with this don't drink and go to Denny's crowd. That was their mantra. Don't drink and go to Denny's. Don't drink and go to Denny's. That was our mantra, you know. So that's what I did. I went to 90 and 90 and, you know, a lot of meetings, and that's what I did. I mean, I was in a meeting in the morning. I went to work. I came back at 5:30. I didn't leave till 10. You know, I went to 10, left at 11 o'clock. I was garbage guy. I was anything you would let me be to just stay here. You know, I felt safe here. And that you know, that power that the fellowship has, that we just, you know, like minds. Like, I connected. Like, I didn't want to be here, but I knew I needed to be here. You know, I knew that. I didn't want to be sitting at Denny's every freaking night. I want to tell you right now. I used to sit there and go, you got to be kidding me. Is this what you do? This is it? Denny's? What do you do for fun? They probably didn't want to tell me that was it. We go to Denny's. And once in a while, we go get ice cream. Yeah. I couldn't believe this had become my life. I'm going to meetings and going to Denny's. And I didn't even know you didn't drink. I didn't. My sister drank all the time. She'd been in AA for years, you know. I didn't know. I was a little disappointed. Forever? That's a long-ass time right there. Forever. I remember trying to go a week. That was difficult. You're talking about no New Year's, no birthday, nothing, no, forever. All right. And I hung on for 90 days, and that's exactly what I did. I hung on for 90 days. I was a little resentful when I found out about a program because I thought I was going to the program. People had told me I was going to a program. I thought I was. I thought I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. I was going to a lot. I wasn't going to a 90 and 90. I was doing a 270 and 90. That's what I was doing. I was in the meetings, man. I thought I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, hanging out with you guys and going to a lot of meetings. You know, I didn't know, you know. And I was 90 days. I picked up my 90-day chip at the Fifth Chapter Club, and I was at the same place in AA that I was at in the hotel room. I can't stand the way I feel for one more second. And, oh, yeah, I can't drink. Now what? And the thought of suicide came back. Like, I can't live like this. Look, I'm an emotional cripple. I don't do life well without medication. I just don't. Doctor prescribed or otherwise, I need medication. Yeah. And I can only white knuckle this thing so long. And I you know, this idea that it's not drinking and go to meetings is going to treat our alcoholism is just, that's a painful way. I mean, how long can you hold your breath becomes the question, right? How long can I hold my breath? I was raging. I was calling my wife and says, honey, I got it. Look, you got to let me back in because I figured it out. I'm an alcoholic. And she's like, no shit. On the other end, you know, she's like, was that a revelation to you? You know, and she's, here's her answer to that. She said, I don't even know if you're an alcoholic or not, but this I do know. You're an asshole who drinks a lot. You know, and she hung up, right? She was right, because right after I hung up, I kicked the water fountain, broke my toe, right? I was breaking mirrors off of my vehicles. I was raging. I leave that meeting. I pick up my 90-day red chip. I go onto the railing in the Fifth Chapter Club. It was on the second floor, and I'm looking over the railing, and I'm going, just contemplating, what do I do from here? You know, I don't know if I can continue doing this. And Brian H., he would use his last name if he was here. Look, we're not anonymous amongst ourselves, for God's sake. You know, press, radio, film, internet, okay. But we're not anonymous amongst ourselves. You know, Pat, right? I live in Coral Springs. It's in the phone book. If you want my number, I'll give it to you after the meeting, right? Brian comes up to me and says, it ain't high enough. And I looked at him. He says, it's only the second floor. It ain't going to work, you know. And then he says, you know, there's a program here. And I go, yeah, I've been coming to the program. He says, no, there's an actual program here. It's called the Big Book. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And he says, would you like to hear it? And I said, yeah. And me and him get into his little Mazda in the back of the Fifth Chapter Club, and he reads the doctor's opinion to me. Now, I don't know where you were hiding that. But that there is some pertinent information right there, right? That was what I needed to know. And that's what everybody wants to know, right? I mean, isn't every addict and alcoholic, the two questions they want to know is, why can't I stay stopped when I swear off? And why, once I start, can't I control it? I think that every alcoholic wants to know the answer to that question. Why do I pick up against my own better judgment? Why am I giving up my life over this drink or this drug? Why can't I do this? You know, and for the first time in my life, somebody answered that question. This obsession of the mind, this idea that overcomes all other ideas to the contrary, this idea that blocks out the truth just before I pick up a drink. This internal condition that's taking place, this restlessness, this irritability, this discontentedness that's taking place internally that makes it impossible for me not to pick up a drink. I can't stand me for one more second. I might blame it on you that you're doing this. If you had my life, you had my wife, you had my job, you had my problems, my lawsuits, my court cases, you'd pick up too. But there's something in me that's just not wired for life without medication. I can't stay stopped. It's impossible for me to stay stopped. It's too painful. It's just too painful. You know, I'm that guy. I'm the Eskimo in the big book. I'm that guy. I'll find a way to get high on ice, man, you know. I'll snort that shit and freeze my brain and get some kind of buzz from that, you know what I mean? I just need to change the way I feel. I'm the guy that'll beat himself on the head with a hammer to stop the internal condition, stop that emotional pain that's going on inside of me. I'll smash my, you know, break my finger, just don't hurt my feelings, you know. I don't do it. I don't do emotions well. And then once that's triggered, once I take that drink, once I believe that lie, I'm off to the races. I can't control the amount I take. Somebody finally explained to me why I never went home. I had no idea. I really didn't. I used to call home when I leave work and say, honey, I'm on my way home, start dinner. And I would go through the drive-through pick and pack, and I would ask for a tall Budweiser for the ride. Give me a tall Bud. Give me a paper bag to disguise that bitch so nobody knows. Nobody to know what I'm drinking. You know. I meant it. I meant when I called, I didn't make the call because I wasn't going home. I meant that start dinner, I'm on my way. And before I finished that tall boy, I was off in another direction. You know what? Dinner's not going to be ready for about 30, 40 minutes. I could stop and say hi to the fellas at the body shop real quick. They always have beer in the refrigerator. I'll have a couple pops with them, and then I'll go home. So I have a couple of beers with them. Maybe they have some other form of medication. And then I start back on my journey going home again. And then Kokomo's is right there. And I thought I could say hi to Bob in Kokomo's real quick. You know, he knows what I drink. And I'll just stop there because I probably... Maybe I'm a little late, but, you know, 10 minutes, what's 10 minutes going to mean, right? And I'd sit down at the bar, and I'd order up a drink. And as Bill said, the next thing I know, I'm looking at the clock, and it's closing time. It's 2 o'clock. And that was my life over and over and over again. You know, I used to promise my son I would come to his football games when he played on Friday night and see him kick off. I couldn't make it. I really wanted, with all my heart, I wanted to see him play. And I would promise, and he would say, Dad, yeah, you said last Friday you'd be here. You didn't make it. He stopped believing me. No, this Friday is going to be different. You know, I'm going to make it this Friday. And I would fall prey again just to that one beer for the ride or, you know, that one hit. You know, that's all. You know, just never made it. Somebody finally told me why. That I suffer from this obsession of the mind and this allergy of the body. My recovery took off from there. I mean, absolutely took off from there. Once I knew that, now I knew what I was treating. Now I knew what the goal was. The goal was to find a power as great as that. That's got to be a pretty powerful deal. You better have something with some depth and weight if you're going to do what alcohol did for me. That's a powerful God right there. You know, you better, and that's what I needed. I needed a power greater than alcohol. That's what I needed. Not a power greater than me, because I'm weak. I have no power whatsoever. I get that. But I need something more powerful than that liquor. I need something more powerful than whatever that dry goods that I was taking, you know. And that's what this whole journey is about from here, is finding that power. But you got to be, you know, this thing about willingness, you know. Man, I see a lot of guys that are willing, you know. I see a lot of guys that want it. I think everybody that makes that walk for that white chip wants it. I don't think anybody makes that walk that isn't 100% sincere when they make that walk. But then something clicks inside, and they leave here, and they're out of the room. They're out of the safety of the fellowship. They're out of the cocoon, and they get out there, and life smacks them in the face again, and they just can't deal with it. Just can't deal with it. You know? And that's our job. You know, that's our job, is to reel that in. William James talks about the requirements. Like, there's no requirement for membership for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the desire to stop drinking. That's the only requirement for membership here. But there's two requirements for a spiritual experience. There's two requirements to find a solution to alcoholism. One, he talks about, is facing an insurmountable obstacle. You know, it's got to be insurmountable. You have to admit that this obstacle is insurmountable. I have no power over alcohol or drugs. I have nothing. That's a requirement to find the solution in this program. The other requirement is to admit that there's no human power that's going to solve it. That my solution must come from a spiritual solution. We use the word God here. We throw the word God around. I don't care what your solution is. You know, spirit of the universe, creative intelligence. You know, Bill gives us a ton of conceptions that we can choose if we want to. You know, God of your understanding. You know, we'll talk a lot about next week. But that's a requirement. You know. I mean, I see guys that are there, they realize that they're facing something insurmountable. Well, what happens 20 minutes later? What happens an hour later? You know, because there's some work to be done. That admission isn't enough. You know, we got to seek it. You know, you have to do some work to find the power. It's not just going to happen. You're not going to get any. Nothing's going to be transferred through osmosis here. You know, you got to do the work. You know. And we'll talk about that next week. Thanks for letting me be here tonight. Mm-hmm. Great job. Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Guys, please help me to thank our speaker again. Now, please let's have Stephanie come up with the secretary's report.
Hi, my name is Stephanie, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I have asked Nancy to please read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Covered but not cured. That represents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for a lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Style Big Book sponsorship from 4 to the 2nd edition, Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. May I please see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? And is there anyone in need of a sponsor? Please raise your hand. Could you please stand, sir? Recovered alcoholic men, let's please get this gentleman back to God. Please join us Monday nights for our Big Book Study meeting where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30 and the Big Book Study starts promptly at 7:15. There is also the picnic Sunday, November 5th. There is the picnic at Snyder Park. There are tickets for sale. Heather is here, as well as Mike Chase has tickets in the back. They are $8 pre-sale, $10 at the park. There will be all the benefits listed up there. And also we have CDs, mugs, large print big books, the little red book, and big book dictionaries for sale in the back, as well as the Marion, Peter Marinelli, Joe Bear, and Tom R. recordings are for sale in the back as well. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. See you next week.
Tonight's session, as well as other podcasts, are online, alcoholicsandgod.org. Just a reminder, there's designated smoking area, which is on this side. Please be courteous to the church, as we've had some talks that they want to make sure we smoke only on the other side. We also invite everyone to our Monday night Big Book Study. And those of us who wish to join me tonight in thanking the speaker, please line up in the center aisle. Let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
See you guys Monday. Godspeed.
Me back on my feet again, never again. Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby, and I hope.
searching with a workflow.